Boren.
May it please the court.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, members of the court. My name is Kevin O'Connell, and I represent the appellant, Robert Allen Gaddis, and I'd like to thank the court for this opportunity to make oral argument on his behalf today. I have previously informed the clerk that I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if appropriate, for some rebuttal, if the court permits that. This morning, I intend to, with the court's permission, address three arguments, basically. One is the failure to recuse argument. The second would be the undue influence argument. And the third would be what we'll call the extrajudicial contact argument. With respect to recusal, I don't think it can be overstated, the anger exhibited by the trial court, not the trial court, but the Superior Court judge, as reflected in the language of her opinion in the Jones case that she had for this counsel, when she issued that opinion. The language that was used included that I was astoundingly libelous, that I was bungling, that I was lame, that I was disrespectful, that my performance was abysmal, that I lied, I was incompetent, I was insulting, I was totally unprepared, I was contemptuous, and I was willing to cast aside all ethical considerations. And in a footnote to the opinion, she indicates that she also suggests that I may have committed what would amount to a felony under Delaware law, that I suborned perjury of the witness that came forward and filed an affidavit in the case. Now, that language alone, if supported by the record, would be troubling, I would hope, to this court or any court. But what makes it more troubling in this counsel's opinion is that it's not supported by the record, that it is reckless in its approach to the facts of the case, and that should make it even more troubling to the court. That opinion was issued on April 10. Mr. Gaddis filed a motion seeking recusal on April 14, and on that same day, and the motion alleged the appearance of impropriety. That is, that the bias of the trial judge toward counsel was of such a nature that it could infect the justice that Mr. Gaddis was entitled to. That same day, albeit within hours, I was faxed a decision by the court denying it in three or four words. The court did not engage in the language, in the analysis required by this court in the Stevenson case. That is a two-part analysis as to whether or not there's actual bias, and then if not actual bias, is there the appearance of bias to a reasonable person as suggested by the record.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes, ma'am.
Am I correct in understanding that this whole argument relates to how many pages were in your brief?
I'm sorry.
That the whole argument of recusal only relates to a decision on how many pages could be in your brief?
No, ma'am. I'm sorry if I gave the court that impression. The opinion issued by Judge Abelman in the Superior Court judge in her opinion in the Jones litigation, a separate case,
right,
capital murder case,
right,
used the language that I described,
right,
days before we filed a motion. Based upon that language, it became reasonably apparent to counsel that she harbored some bias against me, the lawyer. I'm not alleging actual bias right now against Mr. Gaddis. What I'm alleging in my arguments is that her bias against me.
So you're saying that the judge made erroneous rulings of law because of her bias?
I don't think I have to show that, Your Honor. I think that under the analysis set forth by this court in the Stevenson decision, if you show the appearance of impropriety, the analysis ends. In other words, you don't have to show actual rulings or things of that nature.
You mean actual prejudice?
So you don't need to have been prejudiced at all?
Well, the prejudice lies in the very nature of the appearance. This court has set the bar very high in Stevenson by saying that the appearance of fairness is every bit as important as actual fairness. And so in Stevenson, I believe it was Justice Walsh who wrote the opinion, said, if we determine that there is an appearance of impropriety, then the analysis ends there. But Justice Walsh didn't end with that part of the decision. He said, you don't have to show actual bias, but he actually looked to the trial judge in that case, Judge Barron's decision imposing penalty, and he noted the very strong language of that opinion as evidence further to the public that, I'm sorry, did I?
Doesn't the record in this case indicate that at the end of the Gaddis opinion, in addressing your argument that Judge Barron should not have had contact with the jurors, Judge Abelman wrote that in her view it was the same type of personal attack on Judge Barron that you had engaged in the Jones case against her. So we have a connection between the Jones case and that substantive ruling about the propriety of what Judge Barron did in this case. Is that correct?
That is correct, and you anticipated what I was, the words that were just coming out of my mouth is, not unlike Stevenson where Justice Walsh looked at the actual language of Judge Barron and said, this is further evidence, it cements the idea that he had very strong feelings, understandably strong feelings, about the case. The appearances were as such that you don't have to get into actual bias. There's just unfairness by appearance. Similarly, in this case, the language by Judge Abelman in this case was that I had brought the court into disrepute, and by doing so was discouraging other members of the bar from even applying to the court. By my very conduct. And she labeled it a personal attack on the judiciary as opposed to bringing a claim on my client's behalf. So that essentially is the argument with respect to recusal.
Well, just one additional question on that. Apart from the acclaimed appearance of impropriety, which you argue is prejudicial per se, is there any other actual prejudice that you're contending occurred here as a result of the court having issued the Jones decision?
I would say, Your Honor, in 22 years of litigating before the court in both civil and criminal matters, I have not abused the privilege of page limitation and time limitation. I have not continually asked for this court or the Superior Court to give me more time or more pages all the time.
Is that the actual prejudice that you're relying on?
It is evidence of bias, I believe.
No, I'm asking about actual prejudice.
I would say that is evidence of actual bias here in that I asked for a week additional time. It was the first and only request, not opposed by the state.
Okay, my question is in terms of prejudice. Maybe that the bias will prejudice your client.
Correct.
Aside from the denial of your request to exceed a certain page limitation, is there any other claim here of actual prejudice?
I believe that her opinion is written in such a way that she has denied my client relief, and I believe that the decision maker at that point was of such a an ilk toward counsel for Gaddis that that the appearance of unfairness creates the actual prejudice itself. I mean,
apart from that, the only other practical impact from a prejudice standpoint is, as Justice Berger pointed out, the denial of your request to add more pages to your brief.
Yes, sir.
Well, assuming all your arguments are correct and there should have been recusal, doesn't the appellate review by this court of the legal conclusions essentially remedy that?
No, Your Honor, because an impartial tribunal is a structural matter. It's something that just poisons it from the start. But
we're not talking about a trial. We're talking about post-conviction relief, looking at the papers and deciding whether there's a basis for that.
It is not a purely legal decision that was before the court at that point. There were issues of fact, issues of law, blended issues of fact and law that were before the court that I don't think this court, looking at the cold record on review, can necessarily parse out and be able to remedy the situation. I believe
but
that
isn't,
the only...
Isn't that what the trial court is looking at, is the cold record?
No, she had the opportunity to listen to witnesses, to appraise their credibility, to interpret facts as put before her. And I think that means that the case has to go back to a trial court for a fact-finding and a determination of the applicable law and an application of the law to those facts. I don't think that this court can simply look at the record itself and say, well, maybe the court should have recused itself, but we'll remedy that by just looking at the record ourselves. I think that there has to be.
Do you agree all the bases for recusal are courthouse, quote unquote, activities as opposed to some personal problem with you in a social setting or outside the context of actual litigation?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be extrajudicial to this case, but not extrajudicial in the sense of like the Jones case, where it was outside of a trial court setting. It was in a public setting when the actions occurred. I think that it is not simply a situation where counsel is bringing a motion to recuse because there have been some contentious matters in the litigation before the court, some rulings against counsel, and maybe even some personal aspersions to counsel because the court was annoyed with counsel or anything like that. This is a completely separate matter. And in this case, a death penalty case, the court has recognized that the bar is high as far as that second step of the analysis for recusal, where the appearance would give the reasonable person pause to think that there is some bias against counsel, then the court should step aside and let another judge handle it. That would have been the appropriate ruling on that motion, and it's our application that the court reverse that decision and remand us to another judge for their handling, not just of the issue of, to decide the recusal issue itself, on the which I believe it can, but remand to another judge for a full determination of all the issues relating to recusal. If there are no other questions on that argument, I will move on to the what I'll call the undue influence argument. The second argument that I'm making relates to the undue influence given by Judge Barron to the jury vote of 10-2 that aggravating circumstances outweighed mitigating circumstances. Essentially, the jury saying 10-2, we believe death is the appropriate punishment, not life. And the reason, and I'm going to address two things up front because it should, and I imagine they are of some concern to the court, is the first, was this properly petitioned, and secondly, was this properly briefed? It was not petitioned. In the sense of a separate claim that says Judge Barron gave undue influence to the jury vote. It was, as it were, subsumed within a claim made in the amended petition saying the state, based upon litigation in Garden and its synopsis to HB House Bill 287, had misled the court and, I guess, the jury by indicating that the death recommendation or any recommendation by the jury must be given great weight. Subsumed within that is the notion that, in fact, Judge Barron did feel that he had to give great weight to that that recommendation. And it's interesting, the facts that actually cement that claim do not come until well after the petition's been filed and amended once. It comes in the letter response, I believe from October of 2004, where the judge indicates that but for the recommendation of the jury, he stood fully prepared to impose a sentence of life without parole. Now that's very important, that sentence that he puts in that letter, because it reflects his true feelings. And that is, at the close of the penalty hearing, having heard all the evidence at trial, having heard all the evidence at the penalty hearing, it was his independent judgment that life without parole was the appropriate penalty. However, the jury came back with a recommendation of 10-2, and he felt compelled by that vote to reverse his own independent judgment and impose a sentence of death. And but that's where the undue...
Is that the only permissible reading of that sentence? Could it be a way of him saying that he was open-minded, was prepared to impose life, prepared to impose death?
Perhaps that's a way you could read it, Your Honor, but I believe that in a case where death, life and death are at stake, I think that the appropriate remedy might be to remand this back to a different judge and to have Judge Barron either file an affidavit or actually appear in court and answer the question, what did you mean when you said that? Did you mean that when you heard all the evidence, when you heard the evidence in aggravation and mitigation, you'd made your independent judgment that life is appropriate, and then you allowed the jury to trump that? And then secondly, did you feel you had to have let the jury trump that? In other words, like in the situation of Ross, the Ross case that I cite in my brief, that the court felt that it was compelled to do what the jury had said to do because of the way the law read.
Can you cite to us any case where the original sentencing judge was called to testify in a post-conviction proceeding to why he did what he did?
Not in this state, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any.
In any state?
I can't cite the cases right now. I am loosely familiar with cases in Florida where they have called upon trial judges. Well, I would say the Ross case, they remanded it to the same judge. The problem in this case lies in the fact that Judge Barron's retired. In Ross, they simply remanded the case to the trial judge and said, consider it under the proper standard and, give deference or don't give deference, but make your independent judgment as to what you think is appropriate in this case. If Judge Barron were still sitting, we could probably do that, not unlike this court did in the Garden case, where it remanded it to Judge Babiarz and said, look at this, give great weight, and make your own determination as to what you feel is appropriate.
Well, isn't the best evidence of his thinking process in his penalty phase decision itself? He wrote a written decision, didn't he?
He wrote a written decision, albeit after he'd made up his mind, according to that letter, that life is appropriate. He then writes a written decision where he's going to impose death, and he's going to obviously write a decision then that is, he doesn't actually say in that penalty decision that I went through my own thinking process and I came to the determination that mitigation outweighed aggravation. However, because of the jury vote, I'm going to give death. He wrote a rather detailed opinion laying out what were the aggravating circumstances, how much weight he gave to them, and the mitigating circumstances. And then he actually makes very little mention of the jury vote, but to say that he gives it great weight. But I think
Do you recall the length of that opinion? No,
I don't. Not as I stand here. I mean, I can pull it out of the papers. But it's a very detailed, and I would say Judge Barron is known. He writes very detailed opinions, whether it's this case or Flagg or any of the other decisions. He doesn't mail it in. He goes through a great deal of fact-finding. And there's little mention of the jury vote in that opinion. The sin here lies, I think, twofold. One is this court held in Garden that a life recommendation must be given great weight and look to the Tedder case in Florida. But the court also held in its per curiam decision in Garden that a death recommendation is not accorded the same deference. Now, you didn't go so far as, because the issue wasn't in front of you, to say whether you have to give great weight or you could give great, or you could give some lesser standard in the matter, because the issue wasn't in front of you. And if all the legal research I've done, there's not a whole lot of law out there on this issue, and there's a practical reason for that. When a jury recommends death and the court doesn't go along with that recommendation and imposes life, obviously the defendant doesn't appeal that, and the state doesn't have a right to appeal that. So there's not any law out there, really, in Florida or Delaware, really, on the direct question of this. You sort of have to come at the issue from the side, which is what you see in the Ross opinion and several others. But the consistent thing you see in all of the Florida decisional law is with respect to any case where the jury has made a death recommendation is that the court is required to exercise its independent judgment, and that's where Judge Barron committed error in this case. He did not exercise independent judgment. He felt under the law, as he understood it at the time, that he was compelled to give great weight, that he had to give great weight to what the jury recommended. The state, and I won't belie this point, but the state has argued before this court and put before the General Assembly the notion that the 1991 law, that the court was not required to give any deference, great or somewhere less than great, to a life recommendation, and albeit I would assume a death recommendation. They're not arguing before the court now that the court had to give a great weight deference to a death recommendation. And I think there's a reason for that. They believe, like the defense does, that the court is entitled to give whatever weight it chooses to a death recommendation. Would it be totally wrong for Judge Barron to give great weight? Perhaps, perhaps not. What the sin is that Judge Barron felt he had to give great weight to that decision. Not unlike Ross. He felt he didn't have any option. And so what this court, I would ask it to do, is to remand and ask Judge Barron, if you didn't feel you had to give great weight to that jury vote, if you exercised your independent judgment, what would your conclusion have been? Would it have been life or death? The final argument I'd like to address is what we'll call the extrajudicial contact argument, and that involves two contacts by Judge Barron with the jurors between the time of the jury being discharged after the penalty hearing and the time of his decision. Now, understanding the context of that is very important in this case, because you have a letter where Judge Barron says, at the close of the evidence, he doesn't say this explicitly, but I think a fair reading is, at the close of the evidence, I had independently decided that life was appropriate, but the jury verdict pushes me over to death. And so we have a gap period between the jury going out and the jury and him rendering a decision. And during that time period, he has two contacts where there are no court reporter present, no counsel present. It's pregnant with the possibility of unconscious influence. One is he goes into the jury room. Judges regularly do this, and it's not a bad thing to do because jurors do a wonderful thing. Other than military service, probably the best thing you can do for your country and your state is to serve on a jury. It is an important thing to do. And people who sacrifice 4 to 6 weeks of their lives on difficult cases like murder cases where the death penalty is at stake certainly deserve to be thanked. They certainly deserve to be maybe even debriefed. But the problem lies in the fact that the process is not finished when a judge finishes that penalty hearing. He is like a jury deliberating at that point, bless you. He is like a person who is contemplating what the appropriate penalty is, the most important decision he may make in his entire judicial career. And Judge Barron, not for bad reasons, goes into the jury room and has contact. And he says probably some nice things to the jury about their service, but he also says, you've made my job very difficult. And I think her name is Mary Lou Sklar remembered that clearly. Even 13 years later, after her service, she remembered that comment. She interpreted it to mean he probably wanted us to be unanimous. But by his letter, you can see what it means. What it means is he wanted a life recommendation from them.
But he had, in terms of the contact issue, he knew the vote before he went into the jury room. So how does the contact make any difference?
Any contact he has at that point, the jury is almost like the chief investigating officer in the DeShields case. They're an advocate. They have voted for death. At this point, they believe death is appropriate. He thinks life is appropriate. He goes into that uncontrolled situation and has contact with them without counsel present, without a court reporter present, and makes no record of it. And that's where the problem lies. And then, days, weeks later, he sees a few of the jurors walking together out on the street. And again, to the average layperson, that may not seem pregnant with the possibility for error. But this court and litigators understand that you got three jurors out there. Who knows what camp they're in? They may be two of the people who voted for life, but there's a percentage-wise chance at best that these three jurors were people who voted for death. And the fact that they might say to you, you know what, we really hope you're giving that guy death, and we hope what day is the sentencing, which Judge Barron said they did ask him about. So there's some possibility here that some impropriety occurred, maybe not conscious to Judge Barron, but again, he has cemented to him the belief from jurors, perhaps, that death is the appropriate sentence, and he doesn't make a record of it. And he even says himself in that letter to Judge Abelman, is hindsight being what it is, should I have made a record of that? Of course I should have. And why does he say that? Because of appearances, the appearance of impropriety. This court has said on a number of occasions, sidebar conferences, office conferences, teleconferences, whatever you do in a capital case, make a record of it. Because there's a reviewing court in this state and in the federal courts that's going to possibly look at it later. And so making a record of it is important. And in this case, instead of having a record made of it immediately after it occurred and perhaps taking some prophylactic steps and giving counsel that opportunity, it's not immediately, but 14 years later, and you're having to discern from a retired judge and from jurors who have had no contact with this case for a long time that their recollection, and that's where the problem lies.
Mr. O'Connell, your time is up.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court, for the record, Mr. Myers appearing on behalf of the state. Mr. O'Connell mentioned this inquiry is 14 years later after the trial. I think that's a pretty important point to remember. The fact that Judge Barron ran into people on the street was a fact readily available to Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Gaddis when the first post-conviction motion was filed in 1994, I believe, attached to this latest flurry of post-conviction motions was a newspaper article in which the subject is mentioned as clear as day. Judge Abelman decided that under rule that the claim that this particular that the contact claim was reasonably available at the time of Gaddis's first post-conviction motion with the exercise of due diligence, and certainly if Gaddis himself had the newspaper article, states suggest that it's no great leap of faith or logic to expect post-conviction counsel to obtain the information from his client. So because the factual basis was reasonably available at the time of the first post-conviction motion, Judge Abelman decided that the contact claim was procedurally barred under 61(i)(2). In an abundance of caution, Judge Abelman then allowed this string of evidentiary hearings involving the jurors, and perhaps not surprisingly, all of them, all the ones we could find and contact, all of them denied any contact with Judge Barron on the street. All we have is Mary Lou Sklar, the person my learned colleague just referred to, recounting this brief conversation in the jury room after the penalty hearing had been concluded, after the jury had returned its penalty hearing recommendations. Judge Barron's observation many years later that maybe it would have been a better idea, maybe it would have been a good idea to have put on the record that he had run into these people on the street is hardly carries the nefarious interpretation my learned friend wishes to give that statement. What it is, I think, is a realization that instead of having to dredge around in one's memory from 14 years before involving conversations that with people one can barely, one probably wouldn't recognize if you ran them over in the street, the whole thing could have been aired at a time when everyone's recollection was fresh and the issue could have been litigated to the extent that it was going to be litigated with far less aggravation for everybody.
So your point is this issue of contact with the jurors might have been a legitimate issue to raise, but that it was procedurally barred because there was enough information, at least in the newspaper article, to put you on notice of the claim.
Exactly.
Now, what's the record support for saying the very nature of this claim was simply a personal attack on Judge Barron?
It strikes me that if you're in this, it clearly backs into the bias and recusal issue. If you're going to say that a trial judge erred, then just say that the trial judge erred. And I suppose maybe in the context of capital litigation, I'm not insensitive or unsympathetic to the dynamics and demands that the criminal justice system puts on defense attorneys representing capital inmates.
Well, but I don't want you to digress, unnecessarily. You said this was a legitimate issue. If you had notice in the newspaper of the contact, you could have raised it as a claim legitimately. Memories would have been fresh. And so we start with the point that contact between the judge and the juror might be a legitimate basis for raising a claim, albeit in a timely way. So my question is, on the other side of the equation, what evidence is there to support the written opinion that says it was simply a personal attack?
I'm going to suggest that it's what I'll call the nefarious interpretation put on those facts, that the trial judge is, the implication is that Judge Barron is acting in some bad faith way in violation of his judicial oath to sort of stick his fingers in the jury's, reasoning process to come to some preconceived result. I will admit that it's probably not a very articulate way of putting it, but there's this, if I had to try to read between the lines of Judge Abelman's decision, there's a sense of frustration about claiming that trial judges in this state act in bad faith when they do something that turns out not to be the best thing to have done, or simply just for whatever reason stumble into error. Now, having said that, I suppose, in terms of the juror contact issue, I mean, the record is the record. I mean, we went to great lengths to track these people down. Some of them had moved out of state. A couple of them, one or two of them had died. Judge Abelman was open to, I mean, regardless of how she eventually felt one way or the other about the merits of the claim or my friend's insistence on portraying Judge Barron in some demonic fashion, she was open to expanding the record as much as it needed to be expanded in order to resolve this. And the record was expanded. Like I said, I mean, we had, I think, three hearings over the course of several months we either had jurors come in or we got jurors on the telephone in open court. The record is the record. I mean, to suggest that because of her antagonism, for lack of a better word, in the context of the Jones case, that she unfairly skewed the result in this case is simply belied by the record. Stevenson, in this context, is totally distinguishable. The decision in Stevenson turns on the nature of the sentencing decision. Problem in Stevenson was that...
What argument are you addressing now?
I've flowed into the actual bias argument.
All right.
Prompted, I suppose, by Justice Holland's segue, or my segue off of Justice Holland's question. The problem in Stevenson is that because of what the court viewed as, an improper case assignment request by Judge Barron, that his sentencing decision might have been influenced in some way. And because the vote in the jury's recommendation in Stevenson was pretty close, either 8-4 or 7-5, 7-5, I want to say, the court didn't have the necessary confidence in the reliability of the sentencing decision. This case is, we have the record. The record is the record, again, in the context of juror contact, for example, or, what Judge Barron thought about what the eventual sentence might be.
I thought the judicial bias argument had to do with bias on the part of Judge Abelman. Are you addressing the other argument, which is that Judge Barron was unduly influenced by the 10-2 vote by the jury?
I suppose part of the confusion I've generated is because Judge Barron is the trial judge in both of these cases, and so when I.
Well, the judicial bias argument, as I understand it, is number one.
Yes.
Because of the expression used in the Jones opinion, that there's an appearance of impropriety, which in turn generates per se prejudice into the analysis. And the second argument, if there is one, is that to the extent that actual prejudice has to be shown, it was manifested in Judge Abelman's decision to denying the application to file an expanded brief. What is your response?
My response first is, to the extent that my learned friend relies on this court's decision in Stevenson, Stephen is distinguishable for the reasons I've just articulated. The more applicable rule is that articulated by the court in one of the Capano cases, where the court required Capano, if he was going to make a claim of that Judge Lee should have disqualified himself, that that Capano had to articulate specific instances of judicial error that would have been affected, that might have been affected by any bias. Here, as Your Honor just pointed out, in this case, the judicial bias argument shakes out to be, one, Judge Abelman must have been biased against me because she ruled against my client, and two, she was biased against me because she didn't give me, she didn't allow me to file 15 extra pages and take an extra week. As I point out in the brief, in terms of time, Judge Abelman had already extended, when she set the original briefing schedule, she had already given the defense an additional month beyond what she had originally planned. So there was already, instead of my hazy recollection is instead of 1 month, he ended up with two. And then he wanted an extra week on top of that.
Let me make sure I understand your response to the first point, and tell me if I have it right. It's that the expressions in the Jones opinion, whatever they may be, do not create a presumption of prejudice that requires reversal.
That's correct.
That's not the law. That's your
That's first correct. Argument.
And the second is that the denial of the application to expand the size of the brief and let it be filed out of time was not prejudicial either, just for factual reasons.
That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. O'Connell asked that, again, sticking with the bias issue, Mr. O'Connell asked that the case go back to be decided by a different judge. The record, though, shows there are no disputed facts. I mean, at the risk of repetition, the record is the record. There was no disputed facts. It was almost more like some sort of discovery deposition.
So going back to Justice Ridgely's question, is it your position that even if Judge Abelman should have granted the motion for recusal, Gaddis's judgments in this appeal can be affirmed anyway?
Yes, because to the extent that there's an allegation of an appearance of impropriety, the fact that this court is reviewing all the issues in the case acts as a check on whatever bias or impropriety there might have been. And I say that not necessarily conceding that Judge Abelman was biased. In terms of, I'm going to go now to the talk for a few minutes about about the weight Judge Barron gave to the jury recommendation. It strikes me that what Judge Barron says in his letter, the comment he makes, is similar to what happens every Friday morning in Superior Court. The sentencing judges, the judges who have sentencing that day, have read the pre-sentence reports, victim impact statements, so forth and so on. They have some idea what the sentence for each case is going to be. And they go into the courtroom with that sense. But it's not, written in stone yet. A personal statement, in-court statement by the victim or a relative or whatever, a statement in the allocution by the defendant, something that is presented in court that day, that morning, may change the judge's mind about the sentence he's going to impose. In a real sense, that's, I think, a fair reading, a fair interpretation of Judge Barron's observation that from his perspective, from his vantage point, he was prepared to give a life sentence. But the statute also requires that the judge consider the jury's recommendation. And and this, you know, starts certainly with Cohen, the jury acts as the conscience of the community and continues all the way through into Garden. And regardless of where, I suppose, on some scale, the amount of weight Judge Barron should have given to the recommendation, it's clear that under the statute he was required to consider the recommendation. And maybe it's, you know, as he said, I mean, you know, the 10-2 vote represents the community's sense that this crime, this shooting, is not just an ordinary garden variety domestic violence incident. You know, this Gaddis had a violent felony history, past incidents of abuse of women with whom he had romantic involvements. So, you know, going into, so when Judge Barron goes into making his penalty decision, he's fully entitled to change his mind based on the jury recommendation.
You seem to be assuming that he'd made up his mind.
Well, at the end, before he received the jury recommendation?
As he walked into the jury room, or before he heard the jury's recommendation, that he'd made up his mind. Is that what you're saying?
No. No. His letter says, if I recall it correctly now, that he was ready to give, or he was thinking of giving Gaddis a life sentence, and then when the jury, I've totally bollocked up the phrasing of the letter in my memory, and I apologize. But it was something, certainly the jury recommendation was something for him to consider, even if he had tentatively decided in some sort of sense of what the case was at the end of the penalty hearing, but before the jury had returned, even if he had tentatively decided that it was a life sentence case, when the jury comes back with its recommendation, that is surely something he's entitled to consider. With that, if there are no other questions, I'm content to rely on the brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 8 seconds left.
Chief Justice Steele, if there are no other questions, I have no rebuttal argument.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.